This is the second of a series of public lectures given by Miss Ianthe Hoskins at the Theosophical Society head office in London. The talk was given on Sunday the 13th of February 1972 and is entitled The Yoga of Patanjali.
Last week we looked at the Upanishadic tradition and now we look at Patanjali. Now who was he? Very little is known about him, so we can more or less dismiss his biography. Scholars disagree radically on his placing in history. Some put him a few centuries BC, others put him several centuries AD. In other words, they don't really know. And it doesn't matter. What matters is what he said, what he taught. And his teaching, in any case, it does not matter who he was, because the teaching is not original. His best label is the codifier. A codifier. He put together the traditional teaching that was handed down orally, and he was perhaps the first, or certainly one of the first, to put it down in writing. And his work is very small. His work is known either as the Yoga Sutras, which means threads because of the connected argument, the Yoga Sutras, or the Yoga Aphorisms. And the original work is only that size. This is a translation without commentary. Very indigestible without a commentary, partly of the nature of Sanskrit, and partly because what he did is making this handbook was to gather together the essentials and make a teacher's handbook of instruction. Any teacher of the tradition could look at his little handbook and say, oh yes, I've got to talk about that. He would take a few words, he would take the formula, and then he would expand and expand and expound. So that the Sanskrit is very compressed and cannot be well understood without some commentary. But because of the nature of the Sanskrit, because it is compressed, the commentators have a certain amount of freedom in interpreting, and also they differ. Suppose we take a word like grace or faith. What do we mean by it? Well, possibly we mean a lot of different things by it, and each teacher will expound according to his own understanding. So that as you read different commentaries, you will come across different emphases in them, and sometimes quite a different choice of English words. We must remember, I think I've told you, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar, and so I am dependent on the translator. Patanjali's approach is quite different from that of the Upanishads. The Upanishads give you the approach through experience. I gave you several times that verse, the seers saw within themselves the ultimate reality. And then they expressed what they had seen. It is essentially the mystical tradition. But with Patanjali, we are dealing with a scientific approach. It is impersonal, it is detached, and he puts the emphasis on method and on reason. It's rather interesting to see the titles which have been chosen by some of the modern translators and commentators. Some just keep to the title, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But we have two modern ones. One, which is the major work here, the biggest, for those of you who really want to study and want a book that will last you for the next 60 years, take The Science of Yoga by Dr. Tanya. Dr. Tanya was a professor of chemistry in the University of Allahabad, so he approaches it as a scientist, and he uses a good many scientific illustrations, plenty of commentary. But you notice his title, The Science of Yoga. And the other modern one is How to Know God. That is by Isherwood and Swami Prabhavananda, and you will see the emphasis again on method, how to. And that is what Patanjali is trying to do, to explain method and to present his subject scientifically. The Upanishads defined yoga as the calm of the senses and the mind. And Patanjali gives a very similar definition. Yoga is This is the second verse. We speak of his work as being divided into four books or chapters, and the verses, just as in the New Testament scriptures, we speak of verses. So his work is referred to either as a sutra, each small item, a sutra or a verse. Yoga is the inhibition of the modifications of the mind. Now, I'm going over that because there are words of more than two syllables and they need understanding. The inhibition or the suppression, stopping what? The modifications of the mind. The changes that are going on all the time in the mind. I think we saw that also last week in looking at the Upanishadic definition. That our minds are all the time, I think I used the word chattering. They're all the time active, chattering, buzzing away with little bits of internal conversation. And we notice things, we remember things, we look forward. All the time this movement is going on. And that is spoken of as modifications of the mind. Or, in another translation, overcoming the normal tendency of the mind to react to impressions. Now, is that an adequate, a suitable description of our own mental processes? Always reacting to impressions, reacting to sounds, reacting to sights, reacting to circumstances. And so yoga is overcoming the normal tendency of the mind to react to impressions. In other words, taking the title of another translator, the book unfortunately is out of print, The Still Mind. If you can find the book, borrow it from a library by Roy Agard, A-G-A-R-D. But at the moment, I think it is still out of print. His is a sort of paraphrase rather than a translation of the Yoga Sutras, and he calls his version The Still Mind. An excellent title for what the Yoga Sutras are all about. So we have that definition then. Yoga is making the mind quiet. This verse is followed by two verses of explanation. The first one gives us the result. What happens if we do succeed in making the mind really perfectly still? The yogi knows himself as he is in reality. How much of ourselves do we normally know? What do we know about ourselves? With this constant movement inside, with thoughts, memories, anticipations, and desires, constant movement, constant disturbance, we never have enough time to know our own self. As the old oracle said, and as probably many other people have repeated since then, man, know thyself. And when you know yourself, there is nothing else to be known, because you come to that answer that man is, in his essence, the one ultimate reality. So, the result, again, in other words, is the yogi abides in himself. He becomes aware of himself, instead of all this constant movement, the ripples in the mind stuff. So one can say, well, don't we normally know ourselves? If it requires a stilling of the mind to know oneself, what is the normal condition? The normal condition is being caught up in these modifications, in these thoughts and memories and anticipations and desires and worries and all the rest. Caught up in the modifications of the mental-emotional nature. Now, we are not required to take this on trust. What we have to do is to observe ourselves and see whether this ancient psychologist knew what he was talking about. Is this an accurate description of the ordinary person? That he is normally caught up in the movement of the mental-emotional nature. When he is angry, he is lost in his anger. He feels that he is his anger. When he is happy, he is lost in his happiness, and he feels that it is his that is himself. And then there is an explanation of the different mental states which we normally experience. Now, this entanglement of ourselves with different states must gradually be brought to an end so that the mind is made quiet. In another beautiful translation, the spiritual man must be extracted from the psychic man. We have this in the Upanishad also, as the pith from a reed, so must the spiritual nature be extracted from the psychic nature. Several pictures are used in talking about these things. One is of the calm lake. A lake, when the wind is blowing, is so ruffled that there is no reflection, or very broken reflection, of the sun above. But if the wind drops, and so the surface of the lake becomes absolutely calm, then there is a perfect reflection of the sun above. In the same way with man, so long as he is disturbed by the constant movement of mind and desire and so on, there is no reflection of the self that he really is. But if he can bring the mind to rest, abandon desire, and experience perfect quiet, then there is a perfect reflection within himself of that which he really is, of the supreme reality that is his source and his essential being. But this process is a gentle one, a gradual one. There must be no harsh treatment of the mind, no kind of exercise which forces the mind to stop at a given moment. That is not how we treat the mind. The comparison is often made as with breaking in a horse, or breaking in training a puppy, that it is done by gentleness, by a little each day. The stillness is achieved, says Patanjali, by constant practice and by freeing oneself from clinging to anything at all. By constant practice. These are almost the words of the Bhagavad Gita. We should, obviously, as I said last week, we are dealing with one tradition presented in a variety of ways, and so we shall be hearing the same words again. The Bhagavad Gita says, by constant practice and dispassion. Patanjali says, by constant practice and by freeing oneself from clinging to anything at all. In Christmas Humphrey's book on concentration and meditation, he again emphasizes this idea of gradualness. He says, by patient toil, unveil the Buddha light within. The Buddha light is there, but in order to reveal that light, there must be a long, patient work. By patient toil, unveil the Buddha light within. There can be no hurry, no unnatural forcing. You don't climb Everest in 24 hours. So one has to introduce controls gradually, changing the natural tendencies little by little, beginning perhaps with self-observation, observing how our minds normally behave. By selective thinking, choosing throughout the day, choosing what we are going to think about, choosing how we are going to feel, instead of simply reacting. I don't believe Krishnamurti would like being quoted, but I'm going to quote him. A long time ago, he used the phrase, act, act, but never react. When one reacts, one is being provoked by something outside oneself, and the yogi lives from within. What does constant practice entail? He uses, again, three explanatory phrases. It entails regularity of effort, not like New Year resolutions. How long do they last? Regularity of effort and introducing those disciplines that will lead to mental control. and to use these techniques consistently, not erratically, for 3 days and then stop for a week and then begin again. Consistently, over a long period, and in a spirit of dedication. Dedication to the highest ideal, to the highest that one knows, for the service of humanity. And here again I must emphasize what Christmas Humphreys puts so strongly in his teaching, in his concentration meditation, the importance of motive in this way. One does not do these things for personal advantage. And so it is all dedicated. Consistently, over a long period, and in a spirit of dedication. And then freeing oneself from clinging. What does that mean? It means that one no longer allows oneself to be disturbed by desires, by hankering after things outside oneself. Neither goods of earth nor goods of heaven. There are those who will perform various, let us call them penances, austerities, in order to secure a better seat in the hereafter. That is not a suitable motive for the practitioner of yoga. In any case, the heaven world is only a holiday camp on the way back again. And so we may get there, yes, if we work for it. We will get to our spiritual, well, no, it isn't spiritual, it's lower than that, to our Bucklands up above. But after Bucklands, you come back to the office. You return to work. So that if one desires something that is part of the wheel, one comes back, one is tied to the wheel, whichever part one chooses to tie oneself to. So there must be no hankering either after material advantages or after so-called spiritual gains. I can think of someone who used to say, I want to be a saint. Now, I feel pretty certain that her mental picture of herself was having a superior armchair, perhaps at the right hand of the Father. She wanted to be a saint. But she wanted to know herself hereafter as a saint, that she would have a distinctive label. This chair is reserved for you. That is not a motive for the practitioner of yoga. Now, suppose we are really interested. Suppose we feel that there is something in this. After all, remember the rewards. Remember the way in which the results of practice were given in the Upanishad. The way in which the yogi who has attained is described. Self-kingship he attains. Lordship of mind he wins. Lord over speech, Lord over sight, of hearing, Lord, Lord of understanding. Is that attractive? Does it seem to be worthwhile? If so, what shall we do? Now, I think you all have a diagram which has no authority except mine. It is simply a way of representing the instruction given by Patanjali. See, he was a codifier. He liked to put things into neat little lists. 3 of this, 5 of the other, 9 of something else. And so he has the 8 limbs of yoga. And I have put them on the board really just for my own benefit so that I can point to them, but you can look at your own copies, and those of you who want to add something with your pencils, do so as you like, because you take these away with you. At the bottom, we have preliminary qualifications. That is, as it were, the root of the yogic plant. This, as I say, is my own imagination running to produce this plant. And a plant that has not got a root system will be blown over by the spring gale. So there must be a well-established root system. So we have the 3 preliminary qualifications. What do these 3 words mean? We must recognize that various translators have chosen a variety of words, and from them all, I have made up my own choice. because these words seem to represent the ideas better than some that I have found. For example, discipline is sometimes given as austerity. And Isherwood, in his translation, his commentary, points out that the word austerity does sound, he says, like a minister of food telling us to eat less butter. Austerity sounds like privation, doing without. Whereas the essential idea is that of one-pointed energy. And so I prefer to use the phrase discipline, or a general discipline of life, gradually to bring one's life under one's own control. To what extent are we masters in our own house? That is the house of the personal nature. And here, to subject oneself to whatever sacrifices and little disciplinary practices may be necessary for us. Now, it is not mortification. It is not going to Rome with bare feet or with tin tacks in your sandals. There is nothing of that abuse of the physical body, but rather the removal of all excesses and of all dependence on externals. Now, I expect it would be much more interesting for some people if we could have a sensational practice like walking up Oxford Street with a Roman toga or something of the sort as part of the discipline. Because it would be attractive, it would invite interest, and we might feel filled with virtue. But there is nothing like that. It is gradually bringing the whole of the personal nature under control. And just to give you one example, a little exercise which you can practice and you can report progress in a week's time. Control of speech. This you will find referred to in many forms of spiritual treatise. You'll find it in At the Feet of the Master. Those of you who know that book, you must watch your speech. You find it in The Light of Asia. Guard thou the lips as they were palace gates, the king within. You will find it, those of you who make use of the Christian scriptures, I can refer you to the general epistle of James. Those of you who have Bibles at home, go home and read chapter 2 of the general epistle of James on the subject of the tongue. The tongue is a little member, but it setteth on fire the whole course of nature, the wheel of birth and death. And he compares it to the bit that is put into the mouth of a horse. A little thing, and yet with that little thing, the whole animal is turned round. And then he compares it again with the rudder of a great ship. A great ship that can be tossed about by the wind, and yet the captain of the ship, the governor, using the old word, the governor of the ship, can turn round the ship just with the help of the little rudder. In the same way, the man who can control his tongue controls himself. And James says, mankind has learnt to dominate the whole of the animal creation. All the beasts and the birds, man has learnt to dominate. But himself, his own tongue, he has not learnt to control. And so, as a little exercise to practice for 7 days, I suggest that we must be natural about this, there's nothing harsh, avoid the use of the pronoun I. I don't say stop it altogether, there are times when we must use it. But suppose we practice avoiding the use of the pronoun I. It will do at least two things. One is, it will make us more thoughtful of what we are saying. And that is the beginning of control, the observation of our normal behavior. How much of our conversation begins with I. And the other thing is, it will show us how our thinking is largely self-centered. That we are, I quoted last week from Evelyn Underhill, the ridiculous megalomania which makes each of us think of himself as the center of his universe. Now, there will be no sensational results, but if we can just follow out a practice of this kind, we shall begin to see the nature of the yogic life, of yogic discipline. So to establish a discipline in the personal life. Secondly, to acquire understanding, and we have the word study on your paper as a second qualification, study. This is given in commentaries as both self-study and study of the scriptures. Here there is perhaps a difference between the Eastern presentation and the Western, because in the Eastern holy books, all the psychology that one needs is there. So that in studying the holy books, one is also studying psychology, the psychology of oneself. So it is both self-study and study of the scriptures. Everything that will enable us to understand ourselves and the universe and our relationship and so on better. To acquire understanding of our own nature. To observe ourselves and watch ourselves at work. And then the third, I think I've used the word dedication. It is given in most books as the dedication of the fruit of one's actions to Ishvara. Ishvara is the manifested God. But let us, particularly in the Western context, think rather of the unqualified willingness to open oneself to the higher purposes of life, to live according to the highest. Whatever that highest is, however we understand it, if we have a scientific bent, it may simply be truth. To dedicate oneself to the pursuit of truth for no personal gain, but just because that is the most desirable thing in life. An unqualified willingness to eliminate the personal self and to open oneself to this higher purpose. For those of you who have grown up in the Christian tradition, you cannot find a better exposition of this third preliminary qualification than that hymn which begins, "Take my life and let it be ever only, Lord, for thee. Take my hands, take my feet, take my voice," and so on. The whole hymn is a hymn of dedication of oneself to the higher purposes of life. Now, these are preliminaries, preliminary qualifications. You may say, well, why spend time on preliminaries? We want to get on with the business. The reason why there is a great wisdom in this is that one must not begin, or it is really unwise to begin, if we are not in fact ready. Suppose we try these little disciplines, and then we find it irksome. We love ourselves and our habits too much. Then we shall know that we are not ready for the yogic life. So they are preparatory, they are a form of self-testing, of finding out whether we really want to, or whether we're just, let us say, going home with an emotional urge, oh, I would like to practice yoga. That is not good enough. It is over a long period, not 1 week, not 1 year, but a lifetime must be spent. The yogic life embraces the whole of life, and once started, it can never be given up. It must be the whole of oneself and the whole of one's life. Is this really the same principle here as in, let's say, application for university entrance? A professor of mathematics will not accept the student unless he has some guarantee in the form of an O level at least, and preferably an A level, that the student has some competence. And in the same way, it is no use thinking that we can do all sorts of jugglery with the mind if we are not prepared to control speech. We must begin at the beginning. And then also, of course, he that is down need fear no fall. If we aim too high and fall, well, what happens if we are climbing a mountain and fall? We have much further to drop than the people who stay in the plane below. It is unwise to warn ourselves, to warn us of the dangers. There are other reasons, but I can't go into detail with the text now because of passage of time. Now, I would like to say a word about shortcuts, about ways of expanding consciousness, which are popular, that is, which give one a temporary sense of freedom. Because the goal that the yogi has in mind when he embarks on this practice is the liberation of the spiritual self, the liberation of consciousness from the normal fetters of existence, and has been accustomed to looking for easier ways than doing the work himself. One of the traditional methods in the Christian church in order to relieve oneself of one's burdens of sin and so on is the confessional. It is an effective way of relieving certain psychological burdens, burdens of sin and so on. A more modern approach is the psychoanalyst's couch. And then for a few centuries, we have taken to alcohol, tobacco, and more recently, different kinds of drugs. And they do offer some sense of a change of consciousness. Now, the essential difference between all these methods and the yogic method is that yoga makes one dependent on oneself alone. In other words, independent of everything else. I've recently been rereading Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception, where he describes the very interesting changes of consciousness that come about with a little dose of mescaline. Very attractive indeed. The world becomes very beautiful. For most people, I think there are some who have quite a different experience. But he himself points out that although it satisfies the Mary in man, that is the Mary kind of the spiritual consciousness, it does seem to give an opening of something that seems spiritual. It divorces it from the Martha. There is no desire for action, he says. One doesn't even want to think about doing anything. There is a lessening of responsibility. And that it was his experience, and it seems to me a valid expression of the facts. Now, in the practice of yoga, a person is entirely dependent on himself. He does not need a priest. He does not need a psychoanalyst. He does not need a whiff of tobacco or a jab of this or that, or even a phenobarbital tablet or pill or anything of that sort. Because he is able to tap the resources within himself. And so, no matter where he is or what his circumstances, he can find liberty. And once he has found liberty, once he knows the secret, then he is free for all time. Sorry, that's me hitting the microphone. He is free. Now, I found in Swami Vivekananda's expression of yoga this statement, this summary. I think we have Vivekananda's book, copy of it. Vivekananda has a series of books on the different forms of yoga, Raja Yoga, Hatha Yoga, and so on. And at the beginning of the one on Raja Yoga, which is divided, by the way, into two parts, the second part is a translation of Patanjali, he says, each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal. Controlling internal nature, it's controlling the thought life, the desire life, as well as the physical body in which one is housed. Do this, he says, and then he enumerates the different approaches to yoga. By work, that is karma yoga, the yoga of action, or psychic control, or philosophy, by one or more or all of these, and be free. Be free. That is what is offered to man through the practice of yoga. A liberty, an inward liberty. As the Buddha says again in the Light of Asia, I, Buddha, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken with the whole world's woe, laugh and am glad, for there is liberty. O ye who suffer, know ye suffer from yourselves. There is liberty, and the liberating power is within ourselves. It does not reside outside. As I think I said last week in connection with the Upanishadic teaching, there is no vicarious liberation. You cannot be liberated by anything or anyone outside yourself. Each soul, as Vivekananda says, is potentially divine. Now let us look at this. Having done our O-levels, as it were, having prepared ourselves by the practice of the three preliminary disciplines and developed to a certain extent that regular discipline of life, that regular control, that study of ourselves and of the sources of this knowledge, and the third, this purifying the motive, we may say, then we are ready for the eightfold path or the eight steps. He uses a word that, correctly translated, is limbs, the eight limbs of yoga. You have words which are adequate in your diagram. First, the two groups of five at the bottom, this is the ethical preparation. We could divide our plant into three, leaving the root below ground, it must be there, then there are three. There is the ethical preparation, that is those two groups of leaves of five each. Then the three leaves above, I would call the psychophysical, and then the flower, the highest part of Raja Yoga, which we can call the mento-spiritual. Those are the three areas of effort. Now, the ethical preparation consists of what we may call 10 commandments, 5 do nots, and 5 thou shalt. Thou shalt not, and thou shalt. But sometimes it is easier to convey the essential idea by using a positive word rather than a negative, by saying do something rather than don't do something else. And so under the heading of restraints or negative commandments, I put some positive words. Other translators will use, instead of harmlessness, they will say do not kill. Truthfulness, do not tell lies. Well, I prefer the more positive. Harmlessness is the first. And here again, if we feel that this is going to be a way for us in the future, in the course of this life, that gradually we are going to move in this direction, then here is something else that we can begin to think about and to practice. The harmless way of life. To do no hurt. To cause no being to suffer. This may, and sooner or later it will, oblige us to alter our normal diet. You cannot eat meat without killing an animal. When I talk about this to some of my friends, they sound apologetic. They say, oh, well, I only eat a little, you know. I think it's the same from the point of view of the animal. So, harmlessness, in what we wear, how was it obtained? These are things that we must think about. Now, we may not be able to change our way of life overnight, or even during the next 6 months. But this is the direction in which we must be prepared to move. And so we can begin to think about it. Sooner or later, this must come. And harmlessness is the first. Truthfulness. And these apply not only to physical, all of these, but also to the mental and emotional. In other words, we must do no hurt by our speech. We must do no hurt by our thinking. We do hurt by gossip. And we do hurt by gossipy thinking. by thinking, by holding false opinions of people. We harm those people. False judgments. And I regret to say that many of our politicians must be the target of a great deal of cruel thinking. Some of you may think they deserve it, but no. Harmlessness, truthfulness in thought and word and deed, honesty to take nothing that is not ours, and again, this means also not to pretend to be what we are not. All forms of honesty in thought and in act, as well as not taking somebody else's personal possessions. Continence is perhaps better translated as temperance. If there are some books who will which suggest that celibacy is necessary for the yogic life. If it were so, then the yogic life would have no message for the majority of mankind, because the married state is the normal state. And since many practitioners of yoga were in fact married, and the Hindu way of life divided life into certain stages, and the life of the householder was a recognized part of it, it seems that temperance in the sexual life is a better interpretation rather than continence. Non-covetousness, wanting nothing, and also not wasting, not taking more than we need and then wasting it. There's a great deal, each of these words we could spend an hour on. Let us pass on to the observances, the positive commandments. Purity of thought, of word, of deed. This also means selectivity in our reading, selectivity in our viewing, selectivity in magazines, in what we buy, in what we look at, in the entertainments that we go to. All purity is not only physical cleanliness, although that is part of it, but it is also cleanliness of mind and of the desire nature. Contentment is not a cow-like standing in a field chewing the cud. This contentment is that serenity that comes from knowing that all that befalls us at any given moment is right at that moment. It doesn't mean that we have to put up with all kinds of difficult conditions. We can try to change them, but while they endure, they must be endured with serenity. This again we have in the Bhagavad Gita, taking as equal pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat. Or in that beautiful translation of Sir Edwin Arnold, the Song Celestial. The soul that is not moved, the soul that with a strong and constant calm takes sorrow and takes joy indifferently, lives in the life undying. He who is not disturbed, you see, whatever happens to him, he is undisturbed. Self-study? No, we have three more. Discipline, self-study, and dedication. These are the same three that we had as preliminary qualifications. And this is explained by one of the commentators by the fact that they must now be carried to a higher point. Earlier, we were simply testing ourselves. Now, each of these must be developed. And then we come to the more familiar ones, those that have been popularized in Hatha Yoga. Control of body, that is the asanas, the postures. And perhaps it doesn't need any further explanation, except for those of you who were not here last week, the purpose of all this is to make a non-interfering body, to promote health. Because when the body is ailing, it tends to interfere with our higher practices. Control of breath and control of the senses. Here, the textbooks, and commentaries will explain further what those mean. These are disciplines, practices, which have some technical detail. And then we come to the upper, the mento-spiritual part, the flower of yoga. Incidentally, it is sometimes asked, does one have to perfect one stage before one is ready to advance to the next? Some of the books say yes. You must be perfect at one level before you can go on. In that case, I think most of us would stay somewhere right down at the bottom. I'm justified in this by other commentators, the presentation in the form of the flower of yoga, because if your higher senses are doing what mine are doing, that is flowering about 6 weeks later than they ought to, you will have the opportunity of observing the way in which the plant grows. When you buy the bulb and first plant it or put it in water so that you can see it, the whole of the future plant, leaves and flowers, is there already, although it is awaiting development. And when gradually it begins to grow, it all grows. Although for a long time the leaves conceal the flower is developing, and sooner or later it will push its way right through. But the whole thing is growing the whole time. And so it seems more reasonable to take the view, which has support in the commentaries, that effort must be made along all these lines all the time. It is a continuous process and a total process, taking the whole of man, physical, emotional, mental, and raising him to his own spiritual nature. And so we have, as the highest part, the practice, which there is no English equivalent of samyama, but we simply use the Sanskrit term. But it is the three stages, continuous stages, in the process of meditation. Beginning with concentrated thought, then meditation, what is normally understood as meditation, and leading to contemplation or absorption in reality. And obviously that could be the subject of a great deal of study. Now, I would like to give you, to conclude, just a paragraph from Dr. Timely's Science of Yoga, from his preface, because you will see why. I think I needn't say. He first of all discusses the fact that some people will say it all sounds a little bit difficult. Yes, perhaps it does sound a little bit difficult, but nothing worth having is ever had easily, and we are not expected to arrive at the top straight away. We can gradually develop and introduce into our lives some of these techniques. When the inner eye of true discrimination begins to open as a result of the practice of preliminary yoga, that is the yoga down at the bottom, the preparatory disciplines, then the pupil, the student, will cease to wonder whether he is strong enough to undertake this journey. The important point, this is his concluding paragraph in the preface, the important point is to make a definite beginning somewhere and as soon as possible. Now, the moment such a serious beginning is made, forces begin to gather round the center of endeavor and take the aspirant forward towards his goal, slowly at first, but with increasing speed, until he becomes so absorbed in the pursuit of his ideal that time and distance cease to matter for him. And one day, he finds that he has reached his goal and looks back with a kind of wonder at the long and tedious journey which he has completed in the realm of time, while all the time he was living in the eternal.
This completes the talk on the Yoga of Patanjali.